symbolic shadow we now stand, signed the Emancipation Proclamation, a great beacon light of hope to millions of Negro slaves. Yet, 100 years later, the Negro still is not free. The reason that African Americans did not exercise their rights in the intervening century was that they were intimidated by the threat of violence. Not only did the government use force in administering segregation and discriminatory laws, but African Americans were kept in their place by the category of violence called intercommunal conflict, in which one group of citizens, defined by race, tribe, religion, or language, targets another. In many parts of the United States, African American families were terrorized by organized thugs such as the Ku Klux Klan. And in thousands of incidents, a mob would publicly torture and execute an individual, a lynching, or visit an orgy of vandalism and murder on a community, a racial pogrom, also called a deadly ethnic riot. In his definitive book on the deadly ethnic riot, the political scientist Donald Horowitz studied reports of 150 episodes of this form of intercommunal violence spanning 50 countries and laid out their common features. An ethnic riot combines aspects of genocide and terrorism with features of its own. Unlike these two other forms of collective violence, it is not planned, has no articulated ideology, and is not masterminded by a leader or implemented by a government or militia, though it does depend on the government sympathizing with the perpetrators and looking the other way. Its psychological roots, though, are the same as those of genocide. One group essentializes the members of another and deems them less than human, inherently evil, or both. A mob forms and strikes against its target, either preemptively in response to the Hobbesian fear of being targeted first, or retributively in revenge for a dastardly crime. The inciting threat or crime is typically rumored, embellished, or invented out of whole cloth. The rioters are consumed by their hatred and strike with demonic fury. They burn and destroy assets rather than plundering them, and they kill, rape, torture, and mutilate members of the despised group at random, rather than seeking the alleged wrongdoers. Usually they go after their victims with bladed weapons and other hands-on armaments rather than with firearms. The perpetrators, mostly young men of course, carry out their atrocities in a euphoric frenzy and afterward feel no remorse for what they see as a justifiable response to an intolerable provocation. An ethnic riot doesn't destroy the targeted group, but it kills far greater numbers than terrorism. The death toll averages around a dozen, but can range into the hundreds, the thousands, or, as in the nationwide rioting after the partition of India and Pakistan in 1947, the hundreds of thousands. Deadly ethnic riots can be an effective means of ethnic cleansing, sending millions of refugees from their homes in fear of their lives. And like terrorism, deadly riots can exact enormous costs in money and fear, leading to martial law, the abrogation of democracy, coup d'etat, and secessionist warfare. Deadly ethnic riots are by no means an innovation of the 20th century. Pogrom is a Russian word that was applied to the frequent anti-Jewish riots in the 19th century Pale of Settlement, which were just the latest wave in a millennium of intercommunal killings of Jews in Europe. In the 17th and 18th centuries, England was swept by hundreds of deadly riots targeting Catholics. One response was a piece of legislation that a magistrate would publicly recite to a mob, threatening them with execution if they did not immediately disperse. We remember this crowd control measure in the expression, "to read them the Riot Act." The United States also has a long history of intercommunal violence. In the 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries, just about every religious group came under assault in deadly riots, including Pilgrims, Puritans, Quakers, Catholics, Mormons, and Jews, together with immigrant communities such as Germans, Poles, Italians, Irish, and Chinese. And as we saw in Chapter 6, intercommunal violence against some Native American peoples was so complete that it can be placed in the category of genocide. Though the federal government did not perpetrate any overt genocides, it carried out several ethnic cleansings. The forced expulsion of 5 civilized tribes along the Trail of Tears from their southeastern homelands to present-day Oklahoma resulted in the deaths of tens of thousands from disease, hunger, and exposure. As recently as the 1940s, 100,000 Japanese Americans were forced into concentration camps because they were of the same race as the nation the country was fighting. But the longest-running victims of intercommunal and government-indulged violence were African Americans. Though we tend to think of lynchings as a phenomenon of the American South, 2 of the most atrocious incidents took place in New York City. A 1741 rampage following rumors of a slave revolt in which many African Americans were burned at the stake, and the 1863 draft riots depicted in the 2002 film Gangs of New York, in which at least 50 were lynched. In some years in the postbellum South, thousands of African Americans were killed, and the early 20th century saw race riots killing dozens at a time in more than 25 cities. Rioting of all kinds began to decrease in Europe in the mid-19th century. In the United States, deadly rioting began to diminish at the century's end, and by the 1920s, it had entered a terminal decline. Using figures from the U.S. Census Bureau, James Payne tabulated the number of lynchings beginning in 1882 and found that they fell precipitously from 1890 to the 1940s. During these decades, horrific lynchings continued to make the news, and shocking photographs of hanged and burned corpses were published in newspapers and circulated among activists, particularly the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. A 1930 photograph of a pair of men hanged in Indiana inspired a schoolteacher named Abel Mirapol to write a poem in protest. Southern trees bear strange fruit, blood on the leaves and blood at the root. Black body swinging in the southern breeze, strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees. Mirapol and his wife Anne would later adopt the orphaned sons of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg after the couple had been executed for Julius's passing of nuclear secrets to the Soviet Union. When Mirapol put the poem to music, it became the signature tune of Billie Holiday, and in 1999, Time magazine called it the song of the century. Yet in one of those paradoxes of timing that we have often stumbled upon, the conspicuous protest emerged at a time when the crime had already long been in decline. The last famous lynching case came to light in 1955, when 14-year-old Emmett Till was kidnapped, beaten, mutilated, and killed in Mississippi after allegedly whistling at a white woman. His murderers were acquitted by an all-white jury in a perfunctory trial. Fears of a renewal of lynching were raised in the late 1990s when a vicious murder stunned the nation. In 1998, 3 racists in Texas abducted an African-American man, James Byrd Jr., beat him senseless, chained him by the ankles to their pickup truck, and dragged him along the pavement for 3 miles until his body hit a culvert and was torn to pieces. Though the clandestine murder was very different from the lynchings of a century before, in which an entire community would execute a black person in a carnival atmosphere, the word lynching was widely applied to the crime. The murder took place a few years after the FBI had begun to gather statistics on so-called hate crimes, namely acts of violence that target a person because of race, religion, or sexual orientation. Since 1996, the FBI has published these statistics in annual reports, allowing us to see whether the Byrd murder was part of a disturbing new trend. 5 African Americans were murdered because of their race in 1996, the first year in which records were published, and the number has since gone down to 1%. In a country with 17,000 murders a year, hate crime murders have fallen into the statistical noise. Far more common, of course, are the less serious forms of violence, such as aggravated assault, in which the assailant uses a weapon or causes an injury, simple assault, and intimidation, in which the victim is made to feel in danger for his or her personal safety. Though the absolute numbers of racially motivated incidents are alarming, several hundred assaults, several hundred aggravated assaults, and 1,000 acts of intimidation a year. They have to be put in the context of American crime numbers during much of that period, which included 1 million aggravated assaults per year. The rate of racially motivated aggravated assaults was about 0.5% of the rate of all aggravated assaults, 322 per 100,000 people per year, and less than the rate that a person of any race would be murdered for any reason. Since 1996, all three kinds of hate crime have been in decline. As lynching died out, so did anti-black pogroms. Horowitz discovered that in the second half of the 20th century in the West, his subject matter, the deadly ethnic riot, ceased to exist. The so-called race riots of the mid-1960s in Los Angeles, Newark, Detroit, and other American cities represented a different phenomenon altogether. African Americans were the rioters rather than the targets. Death tolls were low, mostly rioters themselves killed by the police, and virtually all the targets were property rather than people. After 1950, the United States had no riots that singled out a race or ethnic group. Nor did other zones of ethnic friction in the West, such as Canada, Belgium, Corsica, Catalonia, or the Basque Country. Some anti-black violence did erupt in the late 1950s and early 1960s, but it took a different form. The attacks are seldom called terrorism, but that's exactly what they were. They were directed at civilians, low in casualties, high in publicity, intended to intimidate, and directed toward a political goal, namely, preventing racial desegregation in the South. And like other terrorist campaigns, segregationist terrorism sealed its doom when it crossed the line into depravity and turned all public sympathy to its victims. In highly publicized incidents, ugly mobs hurled obscenities and death threats at black children for trying to enroll in all-white schools. One event that left a strong impression in cultural memory was the day 6-year-old Ruby Nell Bridges had to be escorted by federal marshals to her first day of school in New Orleans. John Steinbeck, while driving through America to write his memoir, Travels with Charlie, found himself in the Big Easy at the time. Four big marshals got out of each car, and from somewhere in the automobiles they extracted the littlest Negro girl you ever saw, dressed in shining, starchy white, with new white shoes on feet so little they were almost round. Her face and little legs were very black against the white. The big marshals stood her on the curb, and a jangle of jeering shrieks went up from behind the barricades. The little girl did not look at the howling crowd, but from the side the whites of her eyes showed like those of a frightened fawn. The men turned her around like a doll, and then the strange procession moved up the broad walk toward the school, and the child was even more a mite because the men were so big. Then the girl made a curious hop, and I think I know what it was. I think in her whole life she had not gone 10 steps without skipping. But now, in the middle of her first step, the weight bore her down, and her little round feet took measured, reluctant steps between the tall guards. The incident was also immortalized in a painting published in 1964 in Look magazine titled The Problem We All Live With. It was painted by Norman Rockwell, the artist whose name is synonymous with sentimental images of an idealized America. In another conscience-jarring incident, 4 black girls attending Sunday school were killed in 1963 when a bomb exploded at a Birmingham church that had recently been used for civil rights meetings. That same year, the civil rights worker Medgar Evers was murdered by Klansmen, as were James Cheney, Andrew Goodman, and Michael Schwerner the following year. Joining the violence by mobs and terrorists was violence by the government. The noble Rosa Parks and Martin Luther King were thrown into jail, and peaceful marchers were assaulted with fire hoses, dogs, whips, and clubs, all shown on national television. After 1965, opposition to civil rights was moribund. Anti-black riots were a distant memory, and terrorism against blacks no longer received support from any significant community. In the 1990s, there was a widely publicized report of a string of arson attacks on black churches in the South, but it turned out to be apocryphal. So, for all the publicity that hate crimes have received, they have become a blessedly rare phenomenon in modern America. Lynchings and race riots have declined for other ethnic groups and in other countries as well. The 9/11 attacks and the London and Madrid bombings were just the kind of symbolic provocation that in earlier decades could have led to anti-Muslim riots across the Western world. Yet no riots occurred. And a 2008 review of violence against Muslims by a human rights organization could not turn up a single clear case of a fatality in the West motivated by anti-Muslim hatred. Horowitz identifies several reasons for the disappearance of deadly ethnic riots in the West. One is governance. For all their abandon in assaulting their victims, rioters are sensitive to their own safety and know when the police will turn a blind eye. Prompt law enforcement can quell riots and nip cycles of group-against-group revenge in the bud, but the procedures have to be thought out in advance. Since the local police often come from the same ethnic group as the perpetrators and may sympathize with their hatreds, a professionalized national militia is more effective than the neighborhood cops. And since riot police can cause more deaths than they prevent, they must be trained to apply the minimal force needed to disperse a mob. The other cause of the disappearance of deadly ethnic riots is more nebulous, a rising abhorrence of violence, and of even the slightest trace of a mindset that might lead to it. Recall that the main risk factor of genocides and deadly ethnic riots is an essentialist psychology that categorizes the members of a group as insensate obstacles, as disgusting vermin, or as avaricious, malignant, or heretical villains. These attitudes can be formalized into governmental policies of the kind that Daniel Goldhagen calls eliminationist and Barbara Harf calls exclusionary. The policies may be implemented as apartheid, forced assimilation, and in extreme cases, deportation or genocide. Ted Robert Gurr has shown that even discriminatory policies that fall short of the extremes are a risk factor for violent ethnic conflicts such as civil wars and deadly riots. Now imagine policies that are designed to be the diametric opposite of the exclusionary ones. They would not only erase any law in the books that singled out an ethnic minority for unfavorable treatment, but would swing to the opposite pole and mandate anti-exclusionary, un-eliminationist policies such as the integration of schools, educational head starts, and racial or ethnic quotas and preferences in government, business, and education. These policies are generally called remedial discrimination, though in the United States they go by the name affirmative action. Whether or not the policies deserve credit for preventing a backsliding of developed countries into genocide and pogroms, they obviously are designed as the photographic negative of the exclusionary policies that caused or tolerated such violence in the past, and they have been riding a wave of popularity throughout the world. In a report called The Decline of Ethnic Political Discrimination, 1950 through 2003, the political scientists Victor Assall and Amy Pate examined a data set that records the status of 337 ethnic minorities in 124 countries since 1950. It overlaps with Harf's data set on genocide, which we examined in Chapter 6. Assall and Pate plotted the percentage of countries with policies that discriminate against an ethnic minority, together with those that discriminate in favor of them. In 1950, 44% of governments had invidious discriminatory policies. By 2003, only 19% did, and they were outnumbered by the governments that had remedial policies. When Assall and Pate broke down the figures by region, they found that minority groups are doing particularly well in the Americas and Europe, where little official discrimination remains. Minority groups still experience legal discrimination in Asia, North Africa, Sub-Saharan Africa, and especially the Middle East, though in each case there have been improvements since the end of the Cold War. The authors conclude, "Everywhere the weight of official discrimination has lifted. While this trend began in Western democracies in the late 1960s, by the 1990s, it had reached all parts of the world." Not only has official discrimination by governments been in decline, but so has the dehumanizing and demonizing mindset in individual people. This claim may seem incredible to the many intellectuals who insist that the United States is racist to the bone, but as we have seen throughout this book, for every moral advance in human history, there have been social commentators who insist that we've never had it so bad. In 1968, the political scientist Andrew Hacker predicted that African Americans would soon rise up and engage in dynamiting of bridges and water mains, firing of buildings, assassination of public officials and private luminaries. And, of course, there will be occasional rampages. Undeterred by the dearth of dynamitings and the rarity of rampages, he followed up in 1992 with Two Nations, Black and White, Separate, Hostile, Unequal, whose message was, "A huge racial chasm remains, and there are few signs that the coming century will see it closed." Though the 1990s were a decade in which Oprah Winfrey, Michael Jordan, and Colin Powell were repeatedly named in polls as among the most admired Americans, gloomy assessments on race relations dominated literary life. The legal scholar Derek Bell, for example, wrote in a 1992 book subtitled The Permanence of Racism that racism is an integral, permanent, and indestructible component of this society. The sociologist Lawrence Bobo and his colleagues decided to see for themselves by examining the history of white Americans' attitudes toward African Americans. They found that, far from being indestructible, overt racism has been steadily declining. In the 1940s and early 1950s, a majority of Americans said they were opposed to black children attending white schools, and as late as the early 1960s, almost half said they would move away if a black family moved in next door. By the 1980s, the percentages with these attitudes were in the single digits. In the late 1950s, only 5% of white Americans approved of interracial marriage. By the late 1990s, two-thirds approved of it, and in 2008, almost 80% did. With some questions like, should blacks have access to any job, the percentage of racist responses had dropped so low by the early 1970s that pollsters dropped them from their questionnaires. Also in decline are dehumanizing and demonizing beliefs. Among white Americans, these beliefs historically took the form of the prejudice that African Americans were lazier and less intelligent than whites. But over the past two decades, the proportion of Americans professing these beliefs has been falling, and today the proportion who profess that inequality is a product of low ability is negligible. Religious intolerance has been in steady decline as well. In 1924, 91% of the students in a middle American high school agreed with the statement, "Christianity is the one true religion, and all peoples should be converted to it." By 1980, only 38% agreed. In 1996, 62% of Protestants and 74% of Catholics agreed with the statement, "All religions are equally good," an opinion that would have baffled their ancestors a generation before, to say nothing of those in the 16th century. The stigmatizing of any attitude that smacks of the dehumanization or demonization of minority groups extends well beyond the polling numbers. It has transformed Western culture, government, sports, and everyday life. For more than 50 years, America has been cleansing itself of racist imagery that had accumulated in its popular culture. First to go were demeaning portrayals of African Americans, such as blackface musical performances, shows like Amos and Andy and Little Rascals, films such as Walt Disney's Song of the South, and many Bugs Bunny cartoons. Caricatures and logos, advertisements, and lawn ornaments have disappeared as well. The peak of the civil rights movement was a turning point, and the taboo was quickly extended to other ethnic groups. I remember as a child the 1964 rollout of a line of powdered drink mixes called Funny Face that came in flavors called Goofy Grape, Loudmouth Lime, Chinese Cherry, and Injun Orange, each illustrated with a grotesque caricature. Bad timing. Within 2 years, the latter two were made over into a raceless Choo Choo Cherry and Jolly Ollie Orange. We are still living through the rebranding of venerable sports teams that were based on Native American stereotypes, most recently the University of North Dakota Fighting Sioux. Derogatory racial and ethnic jokes, offensive terms for minority groups, and naive musings about innate racial differences have become taboo in mainstream forums and have ended the careers of several politicians and media figures. Of course, plenty of vicious racism can still be found in the cesspools of the internet and at the fringes of the political right, but a sharp line divides it from mainstream culture and politics. For instance, in 2002, the Senate Republican Minority Leader Trent Lott praised the 1948 presidential bid of Strom Thurmond, who at the time was an avowed segregationist. After a firestorm from within his own party, Lott was forced to resign his post. The campaign to extirpate any precursor to attitudes that could lead to racial violence has defined the bounds of the thinkable and sayable. Racial preferences and set-asides are difficult to justify by rational arguments in a society that professes to judge people not by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. Yet no one in a position of responsibility is willing to eliminate them because they realize it would decrease the representation of African Americans in professional positions and risk a repolarization of society. So whenever racial preferences are declared illegal or voted out in plebiscites, they are reframed with euphemisms such as affirmative action and diversity, and preserved in workarounds, such as granting university admission to the top percentage of students in every high school, rather than to the top percentage statewide. The race consciousness continues after admissions. Many universities herd freshmen into sensitivity workshops that force them to confess to unconscious racism, and many more have speech codes, ruled unconstitutional whenever they have been challenged in court, that criminalize any opinion that may cause offense to a minority group. Some of the infractions for racial harassment cross over into self-parody, as when a student at an Indiana university was convicted for reading a book on the defeat of the Ku Klux Klan because it featured a Klansman on the cover, and when a Brandeis professor was found guilty for mentioning the term wetback in a lecture on racism against Hispanics. Trivial incidents of racial insensitivity, such as the 1993 episode in which a University of Pennsylvania student shouted at some late-night revelers to "Shut up, you water buffalo," a slang expression for a rowdy person in his native Hebrew that was construed as a new racial epithet, bring universities to a halt and set off agonized rituals of communal mortification, atonement, and moral cleansing. The only defense of this hypocrisy is that it may be a price worth paying for historically unprecedented levels of racial comity, though it's in the nature of hypocrisy that one cannot say that either. In The Blank Slate, I argued that an outsized fear of reintroducing racial hostility has distorted the social sciences by putting a heavy thumb on the nurture side of the nature-nurture scale. Even for those aspects of human nature that have nothing to do with racial differences, but are universal across the species. The underlying fear is that if anything about human nature is innate, then differences among races or ethnic groups might be innate. Whereas if the mind is a blank slate at birth, then all minds must start out equally blank. An irony is that a politicized denial of human nature betrays a tacit acceptance of a particularly dark theory of human nature, that human beings are perpetually on the verge of a descent into racial animus, so every resource of the culture must be mobilized against it. Women's rights and the decline of rape and battering. To review the history of violence is to experience repeated bouts of disbelief in learning how categories of violence that we deplore today were perceived in the past. The history of rape provides one of those shocks. Rape is one of the prime atrocities in the human repertoire. It combines pain, degradation, terror, trauma, the seizure of a woman's means of perpetuating life, and an intrusion into the makeup of her progeny. It is also one of the commonest of atrocities. The anthropologist Donald Brown includes rape in his list of human universals, and it has been chronicled in every age and place. The Hebrew Bible tells of an era in which the brothers of a raped woman could sell her to her rapist. Soldiers were entitled by divine decree to ravish nubile captives, and kings acquired concubines by the thousands. Rape, we have seen, was also common in tribal Amazonia, Homeric Greece, medieval Europe, and England during the Hundred Years' War. In Shakespeare's account, Henry V warns a French village to surrender or else their pure maidens will fall into the hand of hot and forcing violation. Mass rape is a fixture in genocides and pogroms all over the world, including recent rampages in Bosnia, Rwanda, and the Democratic Republic of the Congo. It is also common in the aftermath of military invasions, such as by the Germans in Belgium in World War I, the Japanese in China, and the Russians in Eastern Europe in World War II, and the Pakistanis in Bangladesh during its War of Independence. Brown notes that while rape is a human universal, so are proscriptions against rape. Yet one has to look long and hard through history and across cultures to find an acknowledgement of the harm of rape from the viewpoint of the victim. Thou shalt not rape is not one of the Ten Commandments, though the tenth one does reveal the status of a woman in that world. She is enumerated in a list of her husband's chattels, after his house, and before his servants and livestock. Elsewhere in the Bible, we learn that a married rape victim was considered guilty of adultery and could be stoned to death, a sentence that was carried over into Sharia law. Rape was seen as an offense not against the woman, but against a man, the woman's father, her husband, or in the case of a slave, her owner. Moral and legal systems all over the world codified rape in similar ways. Rape is the theft of a woman's virginity from her father, or of her fidelity from her husband. Rapists can redeem themselves by buying their victim as a wife. Women are culpable for being raped. Rape is a perquisite of a husband, seigneur, slave owner, or harem holder. Rape is the legitimate spoils of war. When medieval European governments began to nationalize criminal justice, rape shifted from a tort against a husband or father to a crime against the state, which ostensibly represented the interests of women and society, but in practice tilted the scales well toward the side of the accused. The fact that a false charge of rape is easy to make and hard to defend against was used to put an insuperable burden of proof onto the prosecutrix, as a rape victim was termed in many legal codes. Judges and lawyers sometimes claimed that a woman could not be forced into sex against her will because you can't thread a moving needle. Police often treated rape as a joke, pressing the victim for pornographic details or dismissing her with wisecracks like, "Who'd want to rape you?" or, "A rape victim is a prostitute that didn't get paid." In court, the woman often found herself on trial, together with the defendant, having to prove that she did not entice, encourage, or consent to her rapist. In many states, women were not allowed to serve on juries for sex crimes because they might be embarrassed by the testimony. The prevalence of rape in human history and the invisibility of the victim in the legal treatment of rape are incomprehensible from the vantage point of contemporary moral sensibilities. But they are all too comprehensible from the vantage point of the genetic interests that shaped human desires and sentiments over the course of evolution, before our sensibilities were shaped by Enlightenment humanism. A rape entangles three parties, each with a different set of interests. The rapist, the men who take a proprietary interest in the woman, and the woman herself. Evolutionary psychologists and many radical feminists agree that rape is governed by the economics of human sexuality. As the feminist writer Andrea Dworkin put it, "A man wants what a woman has, sex. He can steal it, rape, persuade it to give it away, seduction, rent it, prostitution, lease it over the long term, marriage in the United States, or own it outright, marriage in most societies. What evolutionary psychology adds to this analysis is an explanation of the resource that backs these transactions. In any species in which one sex can reproduce at a faster rate than the other, the participation of the slower reproducing sex will be a scarce resource over which the faster reproducing sex competes. In mammals and many birds, it is the female who reproduces more slowly because she is committed to a lengthy period of gestation, and for mammals, lactation. Females are the more discriminating sex, and the males treat restrictions on their access to females as an obstacle to be overcome. Harassment, intimidation, and forced copulation are found in many species, including gorillas, orangutans, and chimpanzees. Among humans, the male may use coercion to get sex when certain risk factors line up, when he is violent, callous, and reckless by temperament, when he is a loser who cannot attract sexual partners by other means, when he is an outcast and has little fear of opprobrium from the community, and when he senses that the risks of punishment are low, such as during conquests and pogroms. Around 5% of rapes result in pregnancies, which suggests that rape can bring an evolutionary advantage to the rapist. Whatever inclinations sometimes erupt in rape need not have been selected against in our evolutionary history, and may have been selected for. None of this, of course, implies that men are born to rape, that rapists can't help it, or that rape is natural in the sense of inevitable or excusable. But it does help explain why rape has been a scourge in all human societies. The second party to a rape is the woman's family, particularly her father, brothers, and husband. The human male is unusual among mammals in that he feeds, protects, and cares for his offspring and for their mother. But this investment is genetically risky. If a man's wife has a secret dalliance, he could be investing in another man's child, which is a form of evolutionary suicide. Any genes that incline him to be indifferent to the risk of cuckoldry will lose out over evolutionary time to genes that incline him to be vigilant. As always, genes don't pull the strings of behavior directly. They exert their influence by shaping the emotional repertoire of the brain, in this case, the emotion of sexual jealousy. Men are enraged at the thought of their partner's infidelity, and they take steps to foreclose that possibility. One step is to threaten her and her prospective partners, and to enforce the threat when necessary to keep it credible. Another is to control her movements and her ability to use sexual signals to her advantage. Fathers, too, can display a proprietariness toward their daughter's sexuality that looks a lot like jealousy. In traditional societies, daughters are sold for a bride price, and since a virgin is guaranteed not to be bearing another man's child, chastity is a selling point. Fathers, and to some extent brothers and mothers, may try to protect this valuable resource by keeping their girls chaste. The elder generation of women in a society also have an incentive to regulate the sexual competition from the younger one. Of course, women as well as men are jealous of their partners, as a biologist would predict from the fact that men invest in their offspring. A man's infidelity brings the risk that his investment stream will be alienated by another woman and the children he has with her, and this risk gives his partner an incentive to keep him from straying. But the costs of a partner's infidelity are different for the two sexes, and accordingly, a man's jealousy has been found to be more implacable, violent, and tilted toward sexual rather than emotional infidelity. In no society are women and in-laws obsessed with the virginity of grooms. The motives shaped by evolutionary interests do not translate directly into social practices, but they can impel people to lobby for laws and customs that protect those interests. The result is the widespread legal and cultural norms by which men recognize each other's right to control the sexuality of their wives and daughters. The human mind thrives on metaphor. And in the case of women's sexuality, the recurring figure of thought is property. Property is an elastic concept, and laws in various societies have recognized the ownership of intangibles such as airspace, images, melodies, phrases, electromagnetic bandwidth, and even genes. It's no surprise, then, that the concept of property has also been applied to the ultimate in unpossessibility, sentient humans with interests of their own, such as children, slaves, and women. In their article, The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Chattel, Margot Wilson and Martin Daly have documented that traditional laws all over the world treat women as the property of their fathers and husbands. Property laws entitle owners to sell, exchange, and dispose of their property without encumbrance, and to expect the community to recognize their right to redress if the property is stolen or damaged by others. With the woman's interests unrepresented in this social contract, rape becomes an offense against the enfranchised men who own her. Rape was conceptualized as a tort for damaged goods, or as the theft of valuable property, as we see in the word rape itself, a cognate of ravage, rapacious, and usurp. It follows that a woman who was not under the protection of a high-born, propertied man was not covered by rape laws, and that the rape of a wife by her husband was an incoherent notion, like stealing one's own property. Men may also protect their investment by holding the woman strictly liable for any theft or damage of her sexual value. Blaming the victim forecloses any possibility of her explaining away consensual sex as rape, and it incentivizes her to stay out of risky situations and to resist a rapist, regardless of the costs to her freedom and safety. Though the more blatant tropes of the women as property metaphor were dismantled in the late Middle Ages, the model has persisted in laws, customs, and emotions into the recent present. Women, but not men, wear engagement rings to signal they are taken, and many are still given away at their weddings by their fathers to their husbands, whereupon they change their surname accordingly. Well into the 1970s, marital rape was not a crime in any state, and the legal system underweighted the interests of women in other rapes. Legal scholars who have studied jury proceedings have discovered that jurors must be disabused of the folk theory that women can be negligently liable for their own rapes, a concept not recognized in any contemporary American code of law, or it will creep into their deliberations. And in the realm of the emotions, husbands and boyfriends often find themselves cruelly unsympathetic to their partners after they have been raped, saying things like, "Something has been taken from me. I feel cheated. She was all mine before, and now she's not." It's not uncommon in the aftermath of a rape for a marriage to unravel. And finally, we get to the third party to the rape, the victim. The same genetic calculus that predicts that men might sometimes be inclined to pressure women into sex, and that the victim's kin may experience rape as an offense against themselves, also predicts that the woman herself should resist and abhor being raped. It is in the nature of sexual reproduction that a female should evolve to exert control over her sexuality. She should choose the time, the terms, and the partner to ensure that her offspring have the fittest, most generous, and most protective father available, and that the offspring are born at the most propitious time. As always, this reproductive spreadsheet is not something that a woman calculates, either consciously or unconsciously, nor is it a chip in her brain that robotically controls her behavior. It is just the backstory of why certain emotions evolved, in this case, the determination of a woman to control her sexuality and the agony of violation when it has been forcibly wrested from her. The history of rape, then, is one in which the interests of women had been zeroed out in the implicit negotiations that shaped customs, moral codes, and laws. And our current sensibilities, in which we recognize rape as a heinous crime against the woman, represent a reweighting of those interests, mandated by a humanist mindset that grounds morality in the suffering and flourishing of sentient individuals, rather than in power, tradition, or religious practice. The mindset, moreover, has been sharpened into the principle of autonomy, that people have an absolute right to their bodies, which may not be treated as a common resource to be negotiated among other interested parties. Our current moral understanding does not seek to balance the interests of a woman not to be raped, the interests of the men who may wish to rape her, and the interests of the husband and fathers who want to monopolize her sexuality. In an upending of the traditional valuation, the woman's ownership of her body counts for everything, and the interests of all other claimants count for nothing. The only trade-off we recognize today is the interests of the accused in a criminal proceeding, since his autonomy is at stake too. The principle of autonomy, recall, was also a linchpin in the abolition of slavery, despotism, debt bondage, and cruel punishments during the Enlightenment. The idea, seemingly obvious today, that rape is always an atrocity against the rape victim was slow in catching on. In English law, there had been some rebalancing toward the interests of victims in the late Middle Ages, but only in the 18th century did the laws settle into a form that is recognizable today. Not coincidentally, it was also during that era, the Age of Enlightenment, that women's rights began to be acknowledged, pretty much for the first time in history. In a 1700 essay, Mary Astell took the arguments that had been leveled against despotism and slavery and extended them to the oppression of women. If absolute sovereignty be not necessary in a state, how comes it to be so in a family? Or if in a family, why not in a state? Since no reason can be alleged for the one that will not hold more strongly for the other. If all men are born free, how is it that all women are born slaves? As they must be, if the being subjected to the inconstant, uncertain, unknowing, arbitrary will of men be the perfect condition of slavery. It took another 150 years for this argument to turn into a movement. The first wave of feminism, bookended in the United States by the Seneca Falls Convention of 1848 and the ratification of the 19th Amendment to the Constitution in 1920, gave women the right to vote, to serve as jurors, to hold property in marriage, to divorce, and to receive an education. But it took the second wave of feminism in the 1970s to revolutionize the treatment of rape. Much of the credit goes to a 1975 bestseller by the scholar Susan Brownmiller called Against Our Will. Brownmiller shone a harsh light on the historical indulgence of rape in religion, law, warfare, slavery, policing, and popular culture. She presented contemporary statistics on rape and first-person accounts of what it is like to be raped and to press charges of rape. And Brownmiller showed how the non-existence of a female vantage point in society's major institutions had created an atmosphere that made light of rape. As in the common quip, "When rape is inevitable, you might as well lie back and enjoy it." She wrote at a time when the decivilizing process of the 1960s had made violence a form of romantic rebellion, and the sexual revolution had made lasciviousness a sign of cultural sophistication. The two affectations are more congenial to men than to women, and in combination they made rape almost chic. Brownmiller reproduced discomfitingly heroic portrayals of rapists in middlebrow and highbrow culture, together with cringe-inducing commentaries that assumed that the reader sympathized with them. Stanley Kubrick's 1971 film, A Clockwork Orange, for example, featured a Beethoven-loving rapscallion who amused himself by beating people senseless and by raping a woman before her husband's eyes. A reviewer from Newsweek exclaimed, "At its most profound level, A Clockwork Orange is an odyssey of the human personality, a statement of what it is to be truly human. As a fantasy figure, Alex appeals to something dark and primal in all of us. He acts out our desire for instant sexual gratification, for the release of our angers and repressed instincts for revenge, our need for adventure and excitement." The reviewer seemed to forget, Brownmiller remarked, that there were two sexes who watched the movie. "I am certain no woman believes that the punk with the Pinocchio nose and pair of scissors acted out her desire for instant gratification, revenge, or adventure." But the reviewer could not be accused of taking liberties with the intentions of the filmmaker. Kubrick himself used the first-person plural to explain its appeal. Alex symbolizes man in his natural state, the way he would be if society did not impose its civilizing processes upon him. What we respond to subconsciously is Alex's guiltless sense of freedom to kill and rape and to be our natural savage selves. And it is in this glimpse of the true nature of man that the power of the story derives. Against Our Will helped put the reform of rape laws and judicial practices onto the national agenda. When the book was published, marital rape was not a crime in any American state. Today, it has been outlawed in all 50, and in most of the countries of Western Europe. Rape crisis centers have eased the trauma of reporting and recovering from rape. Indeed, on today's campuses, one can hardly turn around without seeing an advertisement of their services. A sticker that is pasted above many bathroom sinks at Harvard offers students no fewer than 5 agencies they can contact. You are not alone. If you have been forced or coerced into sexual activity against your will, there are many people at Harvard who can help. Office of Sexual Assault Prevention and Response, 24 hours. University Health Services, 24 hours. Response Peer Counseling Line, 9 p.m. through 7 a.m. Boston Area Rape Crisis Center, 24 hours. For immediate emergency assistance or to report suspicious or criminal activity of any kind, call Harvard University Police. Today, every level of the criminal justice system has been mandated to take sexual assaults seriously. A recent anecdote conveys the flavor of the change. One of my graduate students was walking in a working-class Boston suburb and was accosted on a sidewalk by 3 high school boys, one of whom grabbed her breast and, when she protested, jokingly threatened to hit her. When she reported it to the police, they assigned an undercover officer to conduct a stakeout with her, and the two of them spent 3 afternoons in an inconspicuous car, a 1978 salmon-colored Cadillac Seville, seized in a drug bust, until she spotted the perpetrator. The assistant district attorney met with her several times and, with her consent, charged him with second-degree assault, to which he pleaded guilty. Compared to the casual way that even brutal rapes had been treated in earlier decades, this mobilization of the judicial system for a relatively minor offense is a sign of the change in policies. Also changed beyond recognition is the treatment of rape in popular culture. Today, when the film and television industries depict a rape, it is to generate sympathy for the victim and revulsion for her attacker. Popular television series like Law and Order Special Victims Unit drive home the message that sexual attackers at all social stations are contemptible scum and that DNA evidence will inevitably bring them to justice. Most striking of all is the video gaming industry, because it is the medium of the next generation, rivaling cinema and recorded music in revenue. Video gaming is a sprawling anarchy of unregulated content, mostly developed by and for young men. Though the games overflow with violence and gender stereotypes, one activity is conspicuous by its absence. The legal scholar Francis X. Shen has performed a content analysis of video games dating back to the 1980s and discovered a taboo that was close to absolute. It seems that rape may be the one thing that you can't put into a video game. Killing scores of people in a game, often brutally, or even destroying entire cities, is clearly worse than rape in real life. But in a video game, allowing someone to press the X button to rape another character is off limits. The "it's just a game" justification seems to fall flat when it comes to rape. Even in the virtual world of role-playing games, rape is taboo. He uncovered just a handful of exceptions in his worldwide search, and each triggered instant and vehement protest. But did any of these changes reduce the incidence of rape? The facts of rape are elusive because rape is notoriously underreported and at the same time often overreported, as in the highly publicized but ultimately disproven 2006 accusation against 3 Duke University lacrosse players. Junk statistics from advocacy groups are slung around and become common knowledge, such as the incredible factoid that 1 in 4 university students has been raped. The claim was based on a commodious definition of rape that the alleged victims themselves never accepted. It included, for example, any incident in which a woman consented to sex after having had too much to drink and regretted it afterward. An imperfect but serviceable data set is the U.S. Bureau of Justice Statistics National Crime Victimization Survey, which since 1973 has methodically interviewed a large and stratified sample of the population to estimate crime rates without the distorting factor of how many victims report a crime to the police. The survey has several features that are designed to minimize underreporting. 90% of the interviewers are women, and after the methodology was improved in 1993, adjustments were made retroactively to the estimates from earlier years to keep the data from all years commensurable. Rape was defined broadly, but not too broadly. It included sexual acts coerced by verbal threats as well as by physical force, and it included rapes that were either attempted or completed, of men or of women, homosexual or heterosexual. In fact, most rapes are man on woman. A survey of the annual rate of rape over the past 4 decades shows that in 35 years, the rate has fallen by an astonishing 80%, from 250 per 100,000 people over the age of 12 in 1973 to 50 per 100,000 in 2008. In fact, the decline may be even greater than that, because women have almost certainly been more willing to report being raped in recent years when rape has been recognized as a serious crime than they were in earlier years, when rape was often hidden and trivialized. We learned in Chapter 3 that the 1990s saw a decrease in all categories of crime, from homicide to auto theft. One might wonder whether the rape decline is just a special case of the crime decline, rather than an accomplishment of the feminist effort to stamp out rape. When we compare the murder rate from the FBI's uniform crime reports, the decline of rape is different from the decline of homicide. The murder rate meandered up and down until 1992, fell in the 1990s, and stayed put in the new millennium. The rape rate began to fall around 1979, dropped more steeply during the 1990s, and continued to bounce downward in the new millennium. By 2008, the homicide rate had hit 57% of its 1973 level, whereas the rape statistics bottomed out at 20%. If the trend in the survey data is real, the drop in rape is another major decline in violence. Yet it has gone virtually unremarked. Rather than celebrating their success, anti-rape organizations convey an impression that women are in more danger than ever, as in the university bathroom stickers. And though the 30-year rape decline needs an explanation that is distinct from the 7-year homicide decline, politicians and criminologists have not jumped into the breach. There is no broken windows theory, no Freakonomics theory that has tried to explain the 3-decade plunge. Probably several causes pushed in the same direction. The portion of the downslope in the 1990s must share some causes with the general crime decline, such as better policing and fewer dangerous men on the street. Before, during, and after that decline, feminist sensibilities had singled out rape for special attention by the police, courts, and social service agencies. Their effort was enhanced by the Violence Against Women Act of 1994, which added federal funding and oversight to rape prevention, and underwrote the use of rape kits and DNA testing, which put many first-time rapists behind bars rather than waiting for a second or third offense. Indeed, the general crime decline in the 1990s may have been as much a product of the feminist anti-rape campaign as the other way around. Once the crime binge of the 1960s and 1970s had reached a plateau, it was the feminist campaign against assaults on women that helped to deromanticize street violence, make public safety a right, and spur the re-civilizing process of the 1990s. Though feminist agitation deserves credit for the measures that led to the American rape decline, the country was clearly ready for them. It was not as if anyone argued that women ought to be humiliated at police stations and courtrooms, that husbands did have the right to rape their wives, or that rapists should prey on women in apartment stairwells and parking garages. The victories came quickly, did not require boycotts or martyrs, and did not face police dogs or angry mobs. The feminists won the battle against rape partly because there were more women in positions of influence, the legacy of technological